Hello and welcome to the After Show Show, the show after the show show, where we talk about things after the show. Blue is looking up a Reddit post.
I can't find it.
I had to use the restroom. There's a lot of things happening here at Casa OSP. You know, none of us exist in the same space, but I like to imagine in my mind that we're all in a little Muppets from Space style house hanging out. Yeah. I'm stealing this bit from our good friend Austin from Rolling with Difficulty, because for many, many years, every time it's come up, he's like, we should all live in a Muppets from Space house, all of our friends. We should be.
There was a point in time where we talked about a fencing house for all of us. It would have been terrible, but the concept was fun.
That's got to be something you're really careful with.
It's getting very close to recreating like a frat house or a sorority house. And I don't know.
But with weapons. What could go wrong?
That's a good point.
As the armorer, I know for a fact none of you guys were taking your weapons out of that cage, because they were not maintained in a way that indicated they had left that building in a very long time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of the tragic truths of reality that somebody you're best friends with might not be somebody you live in the same space well with. And that's a complicated thing to figure out.
And some people just like living alone also, which is completely valid.
Absolutely.
As someone who didn't think that she was going to like living alone very much and then ended up moving into a one bedroom when I moved back to Philly, like, it's great. I love having my own space. I'm excited. I'm moving with my boyfriend soon. I'm very excited for this part of our lives. But it is so extremely cool that every single day I wake up and the only other person in my apartment is a cat who's very upset that she's not been fed yet. And, like, I can walk around in my pajamas for so much longer than I felt comfortable doing when I lived with other people, because I always felt bad that they were going to the office and I was, like, sitting around in my pajamas, sending my little emails. And now I don't feel bad about it at all.
Right. Which is why I think the real winning strat is not everybody lives in one house, but like everybody lives in one town.
Yeah, you know? I think I like that that thing that we're on, because it's very Sims-like to me, is that right now we are designing the ideal friendship-based squad house. And I think that we're onto it with like either an apartment building where everyone does get their very, very much their own space, or like a row of row houses in my mind, but like a row of houses on the same street where like we just dominate the block and like this is our area. And this is sort of the winning formula.
All right, I'm sold. What town are we taking over?
Go Birds, Philadelphia, baby.
Yeah.
Real estate's so much cheap. I mean, buying a house is expensive, but like renting, pretty cost effective. Not to put everyone onto the real secret of the East Coast, but it's a great city.
Philadelphia is absolutely the secret of the East Coast, because what I realized, I think I've talked about this, when I went there twice in a month for one of Cyan's sister's weddings, and then also... PAX Unplugged. That the atmosphere of Philadelphia, which I saw on signs for the birds, was please underestimate us. And I understood immediately that the goal of Philadelphia is for everyone else to think that they suck, so no one else will fucking bother them, and then they can enjoy their city all to themselves with no tourists gumming it up like in New York.
Yeah,
it's genius. Keeps the costs low. It's perfect.
that's the real coup, right? Is like it's actually very cost effective to live in Philadelphia compared to like even like Boston, which is probably the closest equivalent city on the East Coast.
Boston is ridiculously expensive.
Boston
even
is
hotels
insanely
in Boston.
Expensive.
No, but like
in terms of size,
I'll grant you like in terms of size, they kind of fill that same niche of like
New York,
but not and a couple hours away.
It's the deep colonial history, East Coast city of approximately the same size. Like you know, they're doing similar niches. You know, Boston has a big medical community. Philly has a big medical community. There's a lot of similarities. Boston has a lot of colleges. Philly has a lot of colleges. Like, they're doing similar things, and yet somehow Boston is, like, New York priced, and Philadelphia has managed to keep rent really low. Like, rent is high everywhere, but, like, relative to the other cities, like, keep rent pretty low. Hidden gem of the East Coast, babes. We got all that colonial history, too. We just... come see the Liberty Bell. It's free to get in, and definitely not worth it. It is kind of just a bell.
No city's tourism.
But the Constitution Center and Independence Hall are pretty cool, so you should go to those, too.
Yeah.
Constitution Center, I think, is a slept on, because it isn't technically, like, a specific historical location. It is just a museum about the nearby historical locations. And yet, it is one of the best places you can go if you are a tourist in Philadelphia, because it has air conditioning. So if you're there in the summer, you can get a nice little, like, hour of your day where you're looking at some very well-put-together exhibits about the U.S. Constitution, and then you can see those little bronze statues and have a nice little time.
this reminds me of when I was, and then we can pivot on to comics, when I was in Italy for my freshman into sophomore year summer study abroad in Padova. It was a very hot summer, as it often is. Europeans don't have air conditioning. The last weekend of the trip, everybody went to various other places for little like out of town excursions. And I basically stayed in town by myself, which was the correct choice, because I walked around to all of the different like large churches in Padova, which were not strictly air conditioned, but are large stone structures that were very cool and like compared to the outside, like 20 degrees colder to be in. So I was just like hanging out in churches all weekend long. Like if this is religion, maybe I'm actually in because this rules.
God damn.
I do have one final, before we pivot to talk about anything else, Philadelphia architecture related story. And that is, once a year for the last couple of years, Blue has texted me just kind of around the same time, usually after he's recently visited Philadelphia, a picture of Philadelphia City Hall and said, wow, you guys have a really cool, well-designed City Hall. And we've had the same conversation once a year for the last like 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. Trapped in the Philly time loop.
And also what happens is I talk to
rediscovering
people
City Hall
in Philadelphia about Philadelphia City Hall. And I'm like, hey, you guys know, like, this was for a period of time the tallest building in the world, and no one
tallest
fucking cares.
Concrete structure until they built the Washington Monument.
I'm so mad.
It's because there's no reason to be at City Hall unless it's like a holiday and you're doing some holiday touristy stuff, or you're passing through on route to like the Avenue of the Arts or
it's
some shit.
It's so pretty. It's right. It's got a tower. It's a large building, and there's an interior like park space inside.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
Yeah, like you got.
No one cares.
Of course they don't care. Nobody who's from a city cares about the thing that tourists to the city care about. Nobody in New York gives a shit about the Statue of Liberty or Times Square.
Well, Times Square sucks, so like
well,
that's
yeah,
fair.
But that's the thing. Like, nobody in New York gives a fuck about Times Square, but people who haven't been to New York are like, I've heard about Times Square, let's go to Times Square. And it's mm-hmm. like, okay, if you want to be advertised from every direction and show up in the background of 5 million Instagram influencer shots.
Yeah, I think my aversion to City Hall comes from the fact that I used to volunteer with the mural arts program a lot when I was in high school. And one of the things I would have to do is like be one of those people who stands on the corner, or in my case, outside of one of the entrances to the City Hall courtyard, and be like, do you want to join our mailing list? Like, support the arts. Ask me what art can do. And I just faced so much rejection on the western entrance of City Hall that now I'm permanently scarred.
Oh, yeah,
that's
boy.
Fair.
Well, I'm glad Philly's having a nice, fun time. Not appealing to tourists and not giving
there's a lot of good
back to your enthusiasm.
In this city. We have so
under
much
the radar.
Them.
It's the winning strategy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just important to us that we be in opposition to whatever anyone thinks about us. So if they're
of
all like,
so.
We don't like you, then we have to have the most city pride. It's the gritty effect, right? Like,
yeah.
The gritty rolled out and everyone in Philadelphia is like, what is this? And then the rest of the country is like, what is this? And we're all like, well, no, he's
That's
ours.
That's my fucking son.
Excuse you, that is my gritty.
Oh, God. I really respect Philadelphia's unhinged energy compared to the other big name cities in the U.S., you know?
You know, we're a wonderful place to live. I think one of the best things about Philly is our weird artsy culture. We're not all in your face about it like Austin and Portland, but we have the most murals per capita of any city in the U.S. and I think the rest of the world. We're incredibly dedicated to like the theatrical arts and everything. It's a great place if you are in any way creative. And yet, the thing that everyone knows about us and we rest our laurels on is kind of our weird sports mascots.
Yeah. Hey, Gritty's iconic.
Gritty's iconic, and the Fanatic's been holding it down for years before he existed. So you know what? Your city's mascot is not as good as Philly's mascots, regardless of what team you're talking about.
I feel like they didn't even design Gritty. He just spawned in one day when the light levels were low enough.
Someone like put the wrong juice in the Fanatic's tank and like grew a second.
They fed them after midnight and he just appeared.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like we should bring back... I gotta be very careful how I phrase this. So you know how like colonial Britain would like embody Britannia as like a goddess, like Albion, like they basically made up like a patron goddess,
yeah.
like Athena mm-hmm. style, and like there's all this extremely fucked up art of like Lady Progress marching across the U.S. plains.
I think I talked about this in either my video on the British Empire or my video about Meiji era Japan, because it's like all the European countries are like, hey, Japan, come join us.
Right. So like with the understanding that I'm not saying any of that was good, I think it would be cool if we brought back the concept of cities having patron deities, and Philly should get gritty.
I love this.
Yes, yes.
I would make an argument for one of the other, just, like, gritty is a good representation of why Philadelphia is so antagonistic to anyone from anywhere else. But I do think a better representation of us could be given in the form of the Fanatic, or if you want to really stretch it to something nice, Swoop, the Eagles mascot, Go Birds, is just a big eagle, which is pretty representative of the cradle of liberty, city of Philadelphia. This is a point of contention I've had with Boston as well, because my brother's Boy Scout troop was called, like, their catchline is like Cradle of Liberty, because we're from Philadelphia and there's a lot of Independence Hall, the Declaration of Independence is signed here. And then I went up to Boston and I saw a Boy Scout troop advertising up there who also used the tagline Cradle of Liberty, and I was
Those are
fighting words.
Yeah. I think, okay, so like with the traditional iconography, it's got to be like a tall lady, and we can incorporate the eagle, because all these ladies look exactly the fucking same, and it's the iconography.
Well, like Athena, like with the owl, like we can get like an eagle, you know.
It's like how the muses are always distinguished, not by how they look, but by what they're carrying. It's like,
I guess there is an argument to be made that the Statue of Liberty is kind of fulfilling this role for the city of New York, and so it's really just that we're expanding.
Yeah, Lady Liberty gets New York, but like with Philly, it's like, okay, we incorporate the eagle, we put a little gritty on her shoulder, rampant, like a lion. All right, I think we're getting this. Fan art desk Monday.
Yeah, I worry we're just, I don't know how closely you guys follow Gritty's social media team, but dangerously close to a thing that has already happened inevitably on socials.
It's amazing.
Like Philadelphia's patron goddess is like, you know, whatever she looks like, and then there's Gritty on one shoulder and Benjamin Franklin on the other.
Flying
equal
her little
and opposite.
Our patron god is that guy who ate like 30 rotisserie chickens like once a day every day. Only in Philly, baby. New York tried to do a spinoff, and the guy only did it once with like a different food. Nah, yeah, man. True. It's about dedication to the craft.
Everyone knows about Florida Man as the source of all chaos, but Florida Man is but a pale reflection of Philly Man.
Florida Man spreads his chaos everywhere, far and wide. Philly Man stays in his lane, you know? Like Philly Man's doing something weird, but he's doing it for the love of the game, and he's not doing it to bring harm to others.
Florida Man has no control over his life. Philadelphia is the mastermind of its own destiny.
Yeah. We know what we're doing, and we're gonna do it anyway.
Philly Man is purposeful in a way that Florida Man is not.
Yeah.
Great. I'm really appreciative of this theology we're coming up with. I think the U.S. Pantheon could be a really fun thing to explore in future.
So one thing we're missing with monotheism is fun patron deities.
Right? Yeah. Like, everyone's already this prideful about their home city. Now just throw a little bit of religious extremism in there, and nothing could possibly go wrong ever. I think it would be great if Philly and Boston get to have a holy war over which one is actually the cradle of America.
And we'd win.
Well, obviously.
No.
And then they get myths about, like, oh, yes, Dame Philadelphia struck the ground with her trident, and lo, did Orange Crush spring forth in a fountain. I don't know what the national drink
definitely
of
not
is.
Orange Crush.
Boston sails south to attack Philadelphia, but diverts and sacks New York instead in the Fourth American Crusade.
Yeah. A sea of Yingling flows over, much like the molasses flood that formerly overtook Boston.
Dame Boston strikes the ground and molasses bubbles forth in a natural spring.
Oh my god.
Woof.
Fan art desk Monday.
Woo.
Oh.
Man, Neurotypical Red is crazy. This is great. So I was reading Archie Meets the Punisher.
Sure.
The most sane sentence so far of this entire after show.
Of course, because this insanity isn't homegrown. I got it from the store. It's the funny thing is, like, the intro, it's basically the writers and the artists of the comic being like, yeah, we were joking about this for years and years. We were like, yeah, what if we did like a crossover? Archie comes home, his family's been murdered, he hires the Punisher to hunt them down. And then clearly they were like, hang on, I think we might be able to do something here. Like, actually, though. And the end result is this crossover that manages to be sincere in its use of the crossover format without sacrificing the tone or vibes of either disparate element that are being crossed over, which is an unbelievably impressive feat of writing, because I've seen crossovers within the same franchise that can't pull that off.
Yeah.
Mostly the D&D comics I was reading, where it's like, okay, look, the D&D kids from the cartoon where they get isekai'd by a roller coaster are technically in the same universe as Drizdoorden and all that underdark drow matriarchy bondage shit that they're up to, but that doesn't mean I'm expecting them to show up on the same comic page and hang out with each other. But Archie and the Punisher does not work. It shouldn't work. Does work somehow. And one thing that I thought was very impressive is that obviously Archie dealing with Frank Castle is like, whoa, this is serious. And he's just like chilling at like the fucking shake bar, you know, the 1950s place. Just like, oh, I offered Frank a strawberry frosty. Turned me down. Good thing, too. I ran up my tab earlier this week and Max won't swap me another one. And he just continues like noir monologuing for like the rest of the page until he just sort of devolves into listing badass catchphrases from comics. And he's on It's Clobberin' Time when he gets cut off by somebody. And then meanwhile, Frank Castle and his like friend are mostly just like, wow, I didn't know places like this still existed in this hellhole that we call America. You know, that kind of thing. And there's a bit where he like sees this like this guy out with his family walking with his like wife and two kids, and Frank Castle gets a glimpse of the man he could have been were his life not torn apart by tragedy. The joyful life in a small town he could have had he not been formed into the Punisher. And it's like, that is a bafflingly good use of the disparate tone of fucking Riverdale, not the show.
Another thing that I watched in the beginning of the pandemic.
No, definitely not that thing. Just like you put this gritty artifact of the most nightmarishly unpleasant segment of comic history, and you put him in Riverdale, and instead of being like, "You guys don't understand how the real world works," he's like, "I didn't know this place still existed. Kind of sad that it can't exist for me anymore. Now let's get this trouble out of here so these kids can go back to their milkshakes and proms." just a bafflingly good use of the medium, all things considered. Although my standards might have been lowered because I was also reading through the Archie Sonic comics that week, and I was in one of the really boring parts, so maybe I was just desperate for a comic where anything happened.
It's entirely possible.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been reading a lot of West Coast Avengers because there's a comic store near me that went out of business and they had like a 70% off fire sale kind of deal. And also got some, shout out to my boyfriend, who got some incredibly cool art of dinosaurs and wizards for our new apartment.
Whoa.
From the same comic store, just that he found in the back of a bin somewhere.
Perfect.
But I've always liked the West Coast Avengers, a big, longtime Hawkeye fangirl. And the volumes that I picked up are like every other volume of this like compilation of all these issues, so it's fun to try and piece together what happened in the other volumes that I'm missing in the middle, because it's like it spawns like all of the stuff where they go to hell, which is a big portion of it. Tigra has to deal with like the Hellcat people or whatever. And then it's you know, Scarlet Witch and Vision, where Vision becomes Silver Vision or White Vision or whatever it is, and her kids turn out to be figments of her imagination and they disappear. But first they get turned into the arms of Damian Hellstrom, which is insane. If you want to see a single panel from a West Coast Avengers run that will make you lose your mind, look up the two Billy and Tommy demon child arms Damian Hellstrom. It's got to be one of the first results, because I can't imagine this happened more than once, but like, it just looks nuts. And I forget how goofy and unserious like the West Coast Avengers are compared to normal Avengers runs, just because like it is just sort of the B team of whoever they think could be kind of interesting and having on the team at this exact moment. Like Moon Knight's on it for a while, Marvel Man, who's pretty much not shown up in anything outside of the actual comics themselves. They team up with like Hellcat for a while, and there's just a lot of fun stuff going on. And in the background of all of it is Hawkeye and Mockingbird's very contentious divorce. No one on the team stays married for more than a single issue.
Wow.
Yeah. This is Indigo really like, I don't have a lot of like coherent thoughts on it so much as it is just really fun to go back to these and be like, I remember why I like the West Coast Avengers so much. It's because they're so unserious.
Oh, that's fair.
I don't know if they're well written, but they're unserious.
I am strongly of the opinion that a lot of serialized stories like comics and some TV shows are often best experienced sporadically.
Mm-hmm.
Just dive into a random episode and just kind of infer the rest of it from there. Because usually it'll be a nice little vignette of character moments, but the characters will also be like, oh, this is just like that one time, that thing that happened. And it'll be like, yeah, that thing that happened. And you, the audience, are like, shit, did we get to see that thing happen? Is there another thing where we see the thing happen? I'm curious now. it is one of my favorite ways to just sort of get a feel for a comic, is to just pick a random middle issue and just be like, "What? How is this, and how does it feel, and does it make me want to look for more information?"
Can I offer you a comic recommendation, Red?
Yes.
In the middle of Matt Fraction's run of Hawkeye, Kate Bishop, also Hawkeye, goes off to L.A. and has adventures. And they did make a little book of Kate Bishop's adventures in L.A., and she just kind of does, like, private eye stuff. Like, she functions very much like her own little detective agency, but with that same kind of irreverent style. And I think that you would really like that little middle bit, because you don't really need to have read anything else around it. It does stand on its own very well. She teams up with Jessica Jones pretty briefly. Like, it's a lot of fun, very street-level superhero antics, and I think that you get a kick out of it. So if that's Indigo's comic... You know what? I have the title. Hold on. It's on my bookshelf.
Yay! Would it perhaps be Hawkeye 2016?
I mean, that's the run that it's in the middle of, but it's Hawkeye Private Eye is the specific collection
of
just
this
stuff.
The art for the Matt Fraction run is so iconic.
David Aja fucking killed it. That run, it's my favorite run of any comic ever, but, like, it's so good. You can't understate
that, like,
how incredible
you
that art is.
And Austin, my,
I
like,
got
opinion
Austin
pool.
Into this shit.
No, I know, but I hear it from both
Austin
of you.
Austin stole Bards from me in D&D very briefly. I was on this train for years. I was like, Bards are so much fun to play, and Austin would shit on me every session, and he played one Bard once, and he's like, Bards are a great subclass. Like,
yeah, so
I am a prophet.
You were the originator, but I hear it from both of you.
Yes.
And I don't know if this is just, like, me being in the bubble of getting it from you two all the time. But, like, I feel like the Matt Fraction Hawkeye run is, like, the best comic ever from what I hear people,
I mean,
you two saying.
I would
saying.
Say yes. I'm sure someone somewhere has a dissenting opinion about it. But it is just a really incredible run of one specific character. It does something very interesting with, like, the superhero medium. It kind of addresses the whole Hawkeye is not, like... Hawkeye is not Captain America. Like, he is just kind of a guy doing this, and he's good with bow and arrow, and so it manages to make him very impressive and very mundane at the same time. And it gives a lot of love to Kate Bishop, who is one of the best characters of all time, probably my favorite comics character ever.
Hell yeah. I hope we get more good quality Hawkeye season two, because
I don't know that we're going to, but it'd be great if we did.
I like the Hawkeye show a lot. It's the Marvel thing post-Endgame that I liked the most was the Hawkeye show.
We were talking about how it almost had, like, post-Avengers 2012 fandom energy.
Yes.
Of, like, the characters just hanging out, shooting the shit, being goofy, sharing an apartment. And it's like, yes, I want to see these two be roommates.
This is kind of why I think you'd like the Kate Bishop little Private Eye book so much. Because a lot of that is just her and her, like, new collection of friends hanging out and sharing an office space.
Yeah,
and,
no,
like,
I'm definitely
going
to read through it. Because I read through something kind of similar this week, actually. It was a Batgirl run. I feel like it was pretty recent. I don't remember the exact one. But basically the premise was that... all three Batgirls were basically hanging out, sharing an apartment because of some shit that had gone down in, like, a mainline Batman comic. Like, the clock tower they'd been using as a base got blown up and they got framed for it. So you get, like, Stephanie Brown and Cassandra Cain just, like, broing it up the entire time, just absolutely vibing. And then Oracle, Barbara Gordon, kind of just being, like, the den mother and sort of initially living with them and then sort of going off and doing her own thing. There's one episode where she infiltrates the Iceberg Lounge by going on a date there with Dick Grayson. I think that's the only time we actually get to see him. The thing is, like, it's happening at the same time as the currently running, like, Nightwing run. Like, we know what he's up to at the time. He's busy being Nightwing. Yeah. But, like, we'll see her, like, on the phone with him, and, like, we'll only hear her side of the conversation, that kind of thing. But yeah, it was really charming, and the art was very interesting. It changed a couple times, which is pretty normal for serialized superhero comics. You know, they'll swap in artists. But some of them had, like, really solid designs. So this is, like, the first time I'd ever experienced anything about Stephanie Brown, or really Cassandra Cain in any, like, real way, because I know her by reputation, and a character with her name is in the Birds of Prey movie, but... absolutely unrecognizable to Cassandra Cain in the comics.
Yeah.
But she's so good in that. And their friendship with each other is really fun, because apparently the deal with Stephanie Brown is that her father is Clue Master, who's like one of the Batman supervillains whose entire gimmick is that he's such a turbo Chad mega genius. He's so smart. But Stephanie Brown kind of acts like a goofball in combat. Like, Cassandra Cain is, like, the serious, incredibly deadly warrior one, and Stephanie Brown is just kind of fucking around. But then you're like, oh, but one of these guys was actually trained to be an unbelievably clever fighter, and the other one was just trained to be an incredibly deadly warrior. Those are two different but equally competent skill sets. And I thought that was fun, because I love a character who's mostly fucking around, but when they get serious, they get really serious.
Also, shout out Stephanie Brown for having one of the best, like, superhero names of all time in Spoiler, which is so good.
And a very funny thing to name herself after rebelling from her supervillain dad. Like, oh, you want to know everything? Fuck you, I'm a spoiler. Like, hell yeah, girl.
Incredible.
I like
the Birds of Prey movie a lot. I feel like it didn't get the love it deserved. Like, I understand that it's not maybe the greatest thing ever conceived of, but I thought that it held together remarkably well for that era of DC movies. And, like, it does something very interesting with itself, which I think
absolutely.
Is fun.
Absolutely. And it was definitely one of the better portrayals of Harley Quinn. I think, like, her version in that movie is what... Because that came out before Suicide Squad 2, right? Or the Suicide Squad, we're trying it again.
It was
time.
Between Suicide Squad and James Gunn's Suicide Squad.
Yeah, and I feel like that was what turned her movie portrayal from just absolute trash fire to like, this is a really interesting character, let's actually explore it, let's go. And I liked Birds of Prey. I thought it was fun. It's also nice to see Ewan McGregor just to have a good
fucking
time.
Ewan McGregor
time.
Is so fun in that movie.
Because he mostly gets cast as, like, good dudes. Obi-Wans.
Yeah.
But it's like, hey, can you play an unhinged, like, murderer? And he's like, yeah, let's do it. Why not? Can you explode me on screen? Great, amazing.
Put me in 10,000 identical yet very funny printed shirts and let me have a good time.
Yeah. I thought that was fun. And I like the fact that that's a not good portrayal of Cassandra Cain. The fact that they probably just shouldn't have called her that, could have just made her anybody else, is like, whatever. But I really liked her portrayal in the comic. I thought she was a lot of fun there. I don't know. It was a nice little limited run. A lot of comics get kind of canceled after a certain number. It looks like this one only had like 19 issues, which was fine. It was fun. It's always interesting because when you just kind of pick a random comic, you have absolutely no idea what you're going to get. Because some of them are like, wow, this is really solid. And some of them are like, this starts off shaky, but like the writing gets really solid after a little while, which is the experience I had with this one, where initially I was like, this is kind of fun, but it feels like it's looped in with comics I haven't read. And then after a while, I was like, oh shit, they're doing some really good stuff with this. Like, there's a whole issue where there's no dialogue because it's Cassandra Cain focused. And I guess for some of her training, she was supposed to not speak, and she's been sort of teaching herself out of that. But when she gets really serious, she falls back on old habits. So there's just no dialogue anywhere in the comic in that one issue. And I thought that was really cool. And something interesting that you can do when you're playing with the medium, because of course comics are both visual and narrative. So it's like, we're just going to do this one visually. We're not going to... Or you can do the thing where, like, you take a word bubble, but you put a little symbol in it, or, like, a face or something like that.
Well, Matt Fraction's Hawkeye does something very similar, because Hawkeye is, of course, hard of hearing. So, like, he wears hearing aids, which is something that's been consistent for many, many years, even in this West Coast Avengers run. Like, you get reference to it. But I think Matt Fraction is one of the first artists who did something very interesting with it. Or David Aja and Matt Fraction together. But, like... You know, using the medium of comics of, like, it is very visual, so how do you represent that someone isn't quite hearing what's going on? And rather than just doing, like, dotted lines, there's a lot of, like, symbology or, like, panels of, like, lip reading or sign language happening that I think is really... It's a really interesting way to play with the idea of, like, what is the character hearing and what can I, the reader, see to kind of walk you through their thought process. And it's neat to see that happen for a character who's just, like, you know, selectively mute or, you know, reprogramming themselves after their own training and how that represents also.
Yeah, no, it's a lot of very interesting stuff. I also found, Blue, I was actually telling you about this, because I found they did a couple tie-in comic runs to Earth's Mightiest Heroes. Neither of them were particularly long-lived. One of them seems to have only been 4 issues, and the other one was technically like 17, but really only 12, because the last 5 are just screenshots of the show stitched together as panels of a comic with dialogue bubbles put over them, retelling the story of an episode. Which is a very weird choice, because, like, if you don't know much about comics, this might feel like genius. Like, oh, great, we don't need to draw any new art, we don't even need to write a new story, we might punch up the dialogue just a little bit, but that's just because we can make the word bubbles say whatever we want. But you can always tell when they're doing it, because a thing that looks good in a rectangular frame of animation is not the same thing that's going to look good in a comic panel, which you can make any shape you want on the page, and in fact have to make a complicated series of shapes to make them fit together and flow naturally so that your eye is drawn from one to the other. If you just arrange them flat next to each other, like, you know, panels on a storyboard, your eye is going to go left to right and top to bottom, but it's not going to be drawn that way. That's just going to be force of habit. So you can always tell when it's a single frame of animation because it's there's not as much care put into it as you would put into an individual comic panel. So just the art went from being like very solid, and it was drawn by, it feels like it was the same team that makes the indie web the indie comic Atomic Robo, which I was reading for a while. I don't think it's available online, but I was reading it where it was, and it's really good. And I can tell it was that because there's a Peter Parker cameo and he's wearing an Atomic Robo t-shirt. And I was like, I knew it. I fucking knew it. Anyway, nobody else on call knows what that is. It's great. It's whatever. but then so it goes from this really charming art style and very fun, snappy dialogue to like not very abruptly. And then it kind of got canceled after five episodes, quote unquote, five issues. And I wasn't sure what was up with that. But I did also notice that they were doing this thing a lot of comics do where the first like half of the pages would be one complete storyline, and then they would just cut in like a little other thing. They were also doing this in the Sonic comics I was reading through. It's like the first one would be the A plot, and then there would be a B plot written by a different team, drawn by a different team. They were just stacked together. They may as well have been two different issues of two different comics, but they happen to be in the same issue. I'm not entirely sure why they do this. Might be to fill up page counts. Might just be a force of habit. But they were doing this. And the first half would be like an Earth's Mightiest Heroes, you know, episode that we didn't get to see. And that's great. Fine. And then the second part would be Avengers Assemble character bios and Ultimate Spider-Man character bios. Not necessarily Avengers Assemble, but definitely Ultimate Spider-Man. You know, the cartoon where Spider-Man is played by Drake Bell? And none of us watched it because it didn't look particularly good. And we were correct. So just those are getting stitched in, and their version of Nick Fury is getting stitched in, being like, all right, listen up, cadet. Here's a character bio of this guy from this cartoon you haven't watched. And then when you get through that, suddenly there's another little, like, C-plot fun little vignette of Earth's Mightiest Heroes stuff. So it felt like there was some kind of comic mandate going on, because, of course, Earth's Mightiest Heroes got canceled so that Avengers Assemble could be made, which was also worse. For another reason, all the backgrounds in that show are, like, filtered photos of real New York City. I don't know why they did that. It looks bad. Anyway. but it kind of felt like maybe the reason that the quality suddenly tanked after issue 12 was because it was like, we don't have time to write and draw new issues for this show that it's not going to be much long for this world. just slap some shit in there that we already have. Why not? What could possibly go wrong? Just a very odd set of decisions, which smacks of executive meddling to me.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, as an executive who's got a medal, we are coming up on time for the podcast.
Ah, so shit.
We are. I greatly enjoyed the first half, and then I greatly enjoyed the second half. Good job, team.
Yay!
Who takes us out of this? Blue, usually, right?
Usually me. Yeah.
Well, good times.
Well, future after show, we'll have to talk about my adventures with Superman.
That's okay. We've got to table that for later.
Yeah, we'll see how the next couple episodes play out.
Speaking of executive meddling.
So far, yeah.
Well, it's like the first three episodes were pretty good, and then episode four is like, why is it like that? Did something happen?
But they can. We'll get there when we get there.
We'll get there when we get there.
Until then, thank you for listening to this episode of the After Show Show. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another podcast and another ass. But until then, you can check out our YouTube channel, where we'll have a detailed diatribe from Red on Friday, and then the last of my Venice videos in this little series week after that. But till then, I've been Blue.
I've been Red.
And this has been the ass? I don't know. I went out on a limb.
Where's the script for this sucker?